Okay, so thanks for coming back. It's usually the sign of either a decent demo or nothing else to do tonight. I'm hoping it's the former. You actually are enjoying yourself. So the second half here, we're going to be looking at, applying some of these principles we just talked about service orientation and encapsulation and, reuse and things like that. And how does that start to play nicely when we introduce cloud computing vendors? So if you're familiar with SOA now and you're familiar with some of these concepts, all of a sudden engaging some of these new platforms isn't that difficult to embrace what they're doing. So first of all, clearly we need a definition, because if you ask any two people what cloud computing is, you'll get four definitions. So the important thing is, what are we going to agree on? Well, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, I'm sure I butchered that, is a group in the U.S. that's trying to define some standards around this. They're actually working with the U.S. government on pushing some of the cloud computing things. Just yesterday, the U.S. government opened up apps.gov, which is meant to be kind of an app store for cloud services so that internal government agencies can use cloud vendors when they need to do certain functions. So trying to make a good push into cloud computing for cost-saving reasons, things like that. So the key pieces I tried to bold here is cloud computing is about on-demand, self-service, utility computing, in a nutshell. I want to rent processing power. I want to utilize someone else's app framework. And I want to do it when I want to without asking someone to provision it for me and have it scale as much as I want. So, I mean, that's really what we're talking about with cloud computing. And this is different than your traditional ASP or application service provider in that, you typically have multiple tenants on single servers. You have this sort of infinite web scale, cheaper to maintain because typically a cloud platform is a specific thing. It's not like an ASP where you just give me your app and I host it for everybody. It's harder to maintain that. You can do it, but I have to patch everybody differently. Everyone's on different versions. So the key pieces is what you experience if you're a user in cloud computing is you have the at least sense of infinite resources. I can technically scale elastically up or down on demand as much as I want. One of the things I'll show you today is what Amazon offers with their offering, and that me as a user, as I did before this demonstration, can go there and spin up anywhere from one to 1,000 servers instantly, Windows boxes, Linux boxes, whatever I want. I pay for the computing time only. So the equivalent would be I can either rent one server for 100 hours, or I could rent 100 servers for 1 hour, and it's the exact same cost. So really, it starts to come down to is how do you want to do some of this distributed computing? And in this new model, you're not paying maybe a monthly fee per se. You're paying as you go. You're paying for the cycles you consume. You're paying for the data you store, the bandwidth you're transferring. So it's, again, kind of the new model there. And then typically, you have absolutely no idea what the underlying infrastructure looks like. So you're just using someone's framework, someone's platform. So there's three aspects to cloud computing typically, or three delivery models, if you will. There's software as a service, SaaS. I'm not going to abbreviate the other two. Platform as a service or infrastructure as a service. So software as a service is your typical Gmail or Salesforce.com or anybody who's offering you a complete application available over the internet on demand, in a nutshell. So it's a more abstract environment. If you're an administrator of a SaaS application, you have some flips and switches you can do in configurations, but you don't have much control over the underlying platform. You have little visibility. You're buying a finished app. Platform as a service, might be like Windows Azure or the Google App Engine, is I'm giving you a framework. You're putting your app into my place. You don't really know what's going on underneath. I'm not giving you specific servers per se. I'm just saying, put your app into my fabric and run it, and we'll scale for you, and we'll handle some of that. So you have a little more control. You control your app. You control a bit of your security settings. You've got that kind of control. Infrastructure as a service is I want servers from somebody, and I don't want to even host them locally. I want put them in someone else's cloud, and I want access to the raw operating system, raw data storage, raw networking, firewall rules, things like that. Now, the key here is you still only have access to what the provider gives you. So underneath, if they're running a virtual environment, you can't see their actual physical machines. They're hosting all of your stuff. You're getting your access to your sandbox virtual machine. So the pervasive thing in cloud computing, again, is that the underlying platform that's serving it up shouldn't matter to you, and you can't see it anyway. So Microsoft is early or late in the game, depending on who you ask. with what they have with Windows Azure, which is really made up of a few different things. Now it's called the Windows Azure Platform. We'll see tomorrow, it'll be called something different. But for today, it's this. It's made up of Windows Azure, which is the deploy your web app, your service, your PHP app, whatever you want, deploy that into their cloud. You know, you build it yourself, you publish it out there, and it's publicly accessible on the web. SQL Azure is the one that lets you access a SQL server in the cloud. It's the full relational database. You know, if you have ADO.NET code, literally the only thing you have to do is change your connection string to point to the cloud, and you can run the same create, update, select sort of statements. So it's a neat way to store that kind of data. Windows Azure itself has some other storage mechanisms for blobs and queues and really fast read-write objects. And then finally, what we'll focus on is the .NET services. So I think you've seen some of this before when other folks have come and talked, so I'm not going to beat that to death. But what .NET services is really, it's the authorization mapping between different credentials and then the relay bus, the service bus, which lets me take on-premises endpoints and make them publicly accessible via a very secure channel. So again, what I care about now and spending most of my time, at least in the Azure world, is the .NET service bus. I think that's a neat capability that you almost take for granted how quick and easy it is to expose on-premises endpoints into the cloud. So, you know, one of the harder parts of exposing things publicly is you have to put them into a DMZ, and you have to have certain firewall rules, and how do you do security? And it's a real pain in the neck to expose public services, for good reasons, for security reasons and attack surface and those sorts of things. But what this, you know, this is really letting me do is get through all those firewalls and run a service on my office laptop that is now publicly accessible on the web, or my on-site ESB is like we're going to look at. Is my BizTalk server buried within my network could expose a single endpoint to the cloud that my vendors could talk to, for example, or my other trading partners or other business partners. So, it's coming out, and BizTalk's already out, which means there's going to be no support for it. BizTalk sucks. I can't believe it. No, that's not the case. Because the adapter model is actually was built fairly well. It's the you know, you have custom versions of the WCF adapters, which let you use really any binding that BizTalk can squeeze support in there for. So, you know, there's some limits around doing one-way stuff, and there's going to be some limits built in. But for the most part, I can use all of the .NET service bus bindings from within BizTalk today, and actually I'll show you all that. So the neat part is luckily the product was built extensibly enough that when Azure is officially released at PDC this year, I think, in LA, you know, this will already play with what we have. So really the key is because they have this sort of custom thing, it's very easy to leverage it. All right, you want proof? So we're going to talk about how BizTalk itself can, first of all, consume a cloud service. So let's say someone else has thrown out their cloud service out there somewhere. BizTalk wants to consume it. You know, again, one of your partners is exposing it. You want to ask them some information, do it over a secure channel. So what I can do is simply use that binding, and I'm good to go. So let's show how I will host a cloud service and have my BizTalk service bus call that. All right. So because I'm starting with a service, I'm not starting in BizTalk. I've built a regular WCF service that takes newsletter registration. So think about a company that serves multiple customers, and maybe it's the MSDN newsletter, or they also serve up the Oracle newsletter. And it's a single place that ships out email newsletters. And I don't want to do that myself. I'll use another service. So in this case, they want to expose a single operation called register user. And they're going to take in a registered user that tells where are they from and what's their name and what's their email address, do they like HTML email or not, you know, your typical subscription details. So this company wants to expose this cloud endpoint and let all their business partners go ahead and use it. So once I host this, actually I won't go all the way there yet, let's look at the configuration for that real quick in the WCF configuration tool. And what you'll notice is that my endpoint uses the SB prefix for service bus, and I'm using the NetTCP relay binding, which means it's actually going to poke a TCP hole. I think it's over port 808 or 828, depending on security and such. and poke a hole up to that into the cloud and keep that connection open and have that secure means of contacting back to my on-site BizTalk server. So I've got that. I could also use HTTP. I could use other ones based on what ports were open and what was available. And so I've got that service exposed. And if I choose to, I can go ahead and turn that service on. Yes, console apps for a couple more, I promise. So I'm going to start this service. So when I start this service and bind to the cloud, what it's doing is it's saying, hey, Windows Azure Cloud, look at me, I'm right here. So when someone calls it now, it'll reroute it back to my machine. So when it does that first binding, as we wait with bated breath, that it will actually connect successfully. Oh, after lunch, it's not lethargic after dinner. That's good. So it started. We know we have now an active endpoint in the internet. So if you have the right credentials, you could hit this endpoint. I'm not insane, so I didn't make it anonymous, because then there's always some joker who likes to send stuff to my service bus, and I get crazy, you're an idiot messages. So this is a secure endpoint. You know, and actually, to point that out, not the I'm an idiot part, the part that I have a secure binding, I added a cloud endpoint behavior. So this transport client endpoint behavior is where I can choose how I want to do security for my endpoint. So what I've done is done a username password one. Now I could use card space, I could use a couple of other things, certificates for how a user can tell me they're allowed to use this service. In this case, they have to provide a valid username password to call this service. Okay, so my service is running. Now on the BizTalk side, I added a regular web reference to that project. And as typical, you get the bazillion schemas that come in with a web reference. And so I've got my reference now for a newsletter. And I can prove that's the case by having a register user and the empty register response. So again, this is the exact schema for my service. Just I would add any regular web reference if it was on my own machine or in my own network. So in my BizTalk send port then, I've got my newsletter registration send port. And if you'll notice, I'm hitting my service bus address. So I'm telling BizTalk, yep, this guy is hosted in the service bus. It's going to be out there using the WCF custom adapter. Because as you'd expect, there's no built-in drop-down adapter for the service bus. BizTalk doesn't know about that by default. So I pass that in, specifically my binding is the NetTCP relay binding. As you can see, some of the other net prefixed bindings are available, the relay, the peer, so all the other bindings that come when you install .NET services show up here. But arguably the most important thing I had to add here was that same exact behavior you saw back in my service. Because BizTalk's no different than anybody else. To call this service, BizTalk has to pass the right credentials in. Now, again, what's pretty neat is that the model for doing the adapter configuration is smart enough that it lets me plug in the username and password and put all that in my send port and let me maintain it there. So I'm able to tell BizTalk that you have to pass a username password in, and I can give it the username password here as well, which I will not show you because for some unbelievable reason, it stores it all, or it shows it in the clear. I don't trust you that much to simply put my .NET service bus password there. But trust me, it's there. Otherwise, I couldn't call the service. Okay, so that's going to be turned on. Now, when I do start this, I'm not hooking up to the cloud, right? I'm just starting the send port. We'll see later if I receive something from the cloud and I start up my receive location, then I'm doing the same thing that my custom service was doing, which is telling the cloud I'm here. So starting this doesn't do any cloud connection. It just starts it like a regular BizTalk port. On the receiving side, because we're going to live dangerously, I'll use the file adapter, which is the opposite of living dangerously. But I'll pick up the newsletter registration, route it directly to that endpoint, and what we should see is in that console the fact that the registration came across. So let's see. I have my newsletter registration file. So this is the XML schema for newsletter registration. Now, I violated my own rule by using a service schema as now my public interface. Yes, I'm a hypocrite, and I'll accept that. So, you know, I've got Cosmo Kramer, I've got my user here. He's going to go ahead and subscribe for the MSDN newsletter. To prove I'm not completely faking this, let's change the value.
To Norway.
Yeah, you know what? Because if I, yeah, that's true. Because if I don't ask for feedback, I could be changing it to something I've already done. Good call. Now, either or you also could be a plant, and Norway was the one I actually needed. But we're not going to know that, are we? All right, so let's change that to Norway. I suspect by the end of this, I'm going to have hecklers. It's that kind of crowd. So let's go ahead and copy that. And I want to pick it up here. I'm going to make sure I can flip to this pretty quickly. And BizTalk picks it up. It should route it to my endpoint. Now, it's not going to go to the service is running on my machine. That's true. But it's not calling it on my machine. Because remember, I have a service bus endpoint. It technically, BizTalk doesn't know. Oh, I didn't even print the details, though, of Sweden, though. So I could be still a joker. You're going to have to trust that one. So it's a lesson in losing my train of thought. So the key is it didn't know it was on my physical machine, right? It didn't know it was on that VM. I hit an endpoint that was in the cloud, which knew how to bounce back to my virtual machine. So again, you think of all the logistics of this. This is a VM sitting on my desktop, which isn't technically exposed anywhere, and I'm still able to bounce around to the cloud, and I think that's pretty cool that it's that easy to set that endpoint up. All right, so that is sending to the cloud. That's nice. Of course, you're going to say next, well, how in the world do I host one on the cloud? Because that's not enough for me. I demand more. So what we do is we get to really do the same thing in reverse. Is now BizTalk gets to host that endpoint, and it'll do the same sort of security stuff, and now someone calls BizTalk via that cloud endpoint. So let's go ahead and stop it again. So in this case, what I have for this scenario is the idea of a product return. So let's say that I have multiple ways that channels that people can return products from, right? They might walk into a retail store, they might do it from a reseller, they might do it online, whatever it is. And I want to have a single endpoint on my service bus that says, give me your returns, you're tired, you're poor, send this in to me, and then I'm going to go ahead and route it to my product complaint system or my product return system. So instead of setting up 5 or 8 different endpoints to accommodate every single person, I'll set up one cloud endpoint that all my resellers can use and provide to. Now, I also decided to not be a hypocrite and actually build another WSDL here and use my own medicine and use contract first. So I'm using that product schema, and I simply built a product return request and response. Now, in this case, the response isn't empty. I'm actually sending you back a tracking code. Because if you return a product, you might care about specifically what comes back. Okay, so on the BizTalk configuration side, I now have this receive product return port, which once again uses a different but still service bus endpoint. So again, really the piece that has to keep changing every time is what's after the, you know, richardsrouter.servicebus.windows.net. This is the address I'm going to keep changing. In this case, it's a product return web service endpoint. And again, now this time I'm also doing the thing of hosting a service endpoint in BizTalk. So don't frown on me again for doing this, because this actually won't work with services hosted in IIS yet. My understanding is the service bus doesn't let you, you can't use service bus bindings for IIS hosted web services. Pretty sure about that. But I could be crazy, but I think that was the case. No doubting me. You know, let's So the key is at this point I'm hosting this service within BizTalk. Murmur in the crowd. So my behavior and my binding is just like the last time. I'm using the NetTCP relay binding. That's how we're going to punch the hole back to my BizTalk server in my virtual machine. And again, much like the other case, I've got the transport client endpoint behavior. And if you remember, I mean, if I'm in the BizTalk adapter, I can simply add the extension, and that's where those values all show up. That one that came from the service bus just showed up in this list because it's registered as a standard behavior for the box, and BizTalk just picks that up. So, again, no fancy stuff to use the same behaviors. So what I've done is say, okay, BizTalk's going to host this. It's also going to require the username password to call it in. Now, I could choose to not use any security and do it anonymous to the cloud, but do security once it gets into BizTalk. So again, that's a question of responsibility again, is where do I want to broker people? Do I want to say, you can't even call the service unless you provide me credentials? Or do I want to say, well, maybe it's a Java app that has no idea about WCF.NET service bindings. Let's have it anonymously called, and when it gets back to my broker, I do some sort of authentication via some other means. That's where you have to look at your vendor, your different consumers, and say, what's the smartest way for me to authenticate the widest population? In this case, I'm strictly limiting it to .NET consumers. So I've got this. Now, the key is when I turn this on, I am now, for it to be enabled successfully, again, it has to go to the cloud, tell the .NET service bus, yep, I'm a real endpoint, and create that open TCP connection, which is if it stays enabled after I refresh. Good times. That means it actually did hook up to the cloud. So right now I have a valid cloud endpoint. Now, the one thing I haven't figured out yet how to do is when I do this via code, that service I wrote before, I can add a little behavior that makes it show up in an online registry of services that I've provided. So if you hit the Richard Sirother.serviceboss.yada yada, it would actually show you my service. What I don't know how to do myself yet is I don't know how to make that behavior show up when I host it in BizTalk. So the only way you would know about this endpoint is if I gave you the URL. You don't get that sort of feed, RSS feed, about my endpoints.
Metadata exchange doesn't work with that?
Metadata exchange. To get it to show up in that registry in the first place, though, I think is what that behavior does. I think you might still be able to ping this with a MEX request or a WSDL request if you knew the URL. But there's no discovery of the URL automatically. Okay, so I've got that turned on. I think I'm doing something else, too. Oh, that's right. There's an orchestration. So I've got that, and then I've got my handle product returns orchestration, which all this guy does is take in the product return, set a tracking code, and give that guy back to the caller, is what he's doing. All right. This is all very exciting. So I've got my endpoint. I've got my orchestration. I'm going to shift to the magical world of console apps again. I think this could be the last one. And what this is going to do is now it's going to call the service bus, which once again routes it back to my ESB, my BizTalk server, does all of its stuff, and hopefully returns me a tracking code, which my on-site ESB generated. So it's really tying again, all together again, where think about it, how many BizTalk installations floating around, how neat would it be to take an endpoint, not the whole thing, I don't have to move the whole thing into my DMZ and my environment, I expose 1, 2, 3 strategic endpoints to cloud providers, to cloud consumers, and really open up the way I can use my service bus for all different types of users. Oh, good times. So I get my GUID-based tracking code, which of course we all love and like to write down and plug into other tools. And there you go. So in this case, BizTalk was the actual cloud endpoint, and I was able to call this that way. So yes, lots of cool, interesting possibilities for this you can think about for how I expose and consume this. So my on-site ESP, as we think about cloud computing, and maybe your first thought is, okay, I need a cloud integration broker that integrates in the cloud, and that's my only solution. Not necessarily. I might choose to keep my investment on on-premises ESP and use that as my cloud orchestration engine. I mean, nothing says I can't keep the capabilities I want in my data center and just use it to expose and consume stuff in the cloud. And again, that is a capability now that I could do with the service bus securely. Okay, so I like you guys, and I thought that simple scenarios are no fun, and clearly I should spend months building something more interesting. So what I have, and we'll take this one by one, is I built a Python-based service in the Google App Engine, because the Google App Engine lets you put Java or Python apps into their public little framework thing. And so I built a service there. Let's quick take a look at my Python code and app. So I've got a customer object that I put into the Google database. I have a GET operation so that if I send an HTTP message to my endpoint, I go ahead and strip out the XML payload, query that database, asking for the customer you just asked for. And then I go ahead and give them back, I can't stretch any lower, I give them back an XML response. So in this whole scenario, what I'm going to be showing you is I've got customer data sitting all over the place, and what I want to do is have a single service that says just get customer and go get the information from those different places, mash it up, and just give me one service that says get customer, which actually goes and calls a bunch of other things. So in this case, Google App Engine is mastering some customer data. In my case, about which people are registering for beta access to my application programs or whatever my company does. Now I can see the Google App Engine. Again, these are free accounts, so anybody can sign up and mess around and do things. So I can see how much I'm calling my service. It's free until I hit certain limits of storage and bandwidth and CPU cycles and things like that. And I wrote a little custom Python that my Python code actually translates to this application, which lets me add new customers, and delete customers and things like that. And this is a public internet address. So, I'll tell you now, because hopefully by the time I've done this, I'll turn this off before the video gets distributed. This is a public URL that technically you can go and completely hose me for the rest of the demo. I'm putting that out there. Hoping you won't do that, but it's neat. I could lock this down if I wanted, say only if you have a certain Google App account or only this or that. And I could put security here, but that's harder, and why should I do that? So I've gone ahead and kind of put an open app out there that takes data, stores it into the Google database system, and then also serves it out via HTTP requests. So that's the first piece of my solution. Next, what I want to do is take that information from Google, and then use Salesforce.com, which is a great SaaS provider for CRM stuff. So I want to, first of all, start jamming those together. So Salesforce.com, once again, lets you have free developer accounts. So I've gone ahead and created my own little CRM application. And I can see all the contacts that I'm doing. I can see all sorts of interesting stuff. But what most importantly for our scenario is I went ahead and created things are written in Salesforce.com using a language called Apex, which is kind of a Java-y, C-sharp-y type thing. And what I've done is write a service which is simply a get customer details by ID. So you give me an ID, I query the Salesforce.com database, and I return that customer object back. Okay, not rocket science, but simple service that wasn't exposed by default. Now the reason this wasn't exposed by default is I added some new fields. For example, I put a global identifier into Salesforce so that the same ID in Salesforce is the same ID in the Google App Engine and the same ID in my on-premises app. So now I can just use one ID and say, get me everybody who knows everything about customer 123. So I had to write my own service that knew about my custom fields. Now what's neat is once I have this, by default, I also get a WSDL out of it. So it'll show me here the WSDL for that service, and I can consume this in BizTalk, as I'll show you, and call this just like I would call any on-premises service, but this is calling the Salesforce engine. Now, of course, to make it even more complicated, the service that calls get customer is sitting on a virtual machine I spun up in Amazon's EC2 environment. Because, yes, you need more moving pieces for every working solution for job security. So that's just me. So, okay. So what this looks like is I've got the Google App Engine thing. You register for beta access to an application. My primary information about all my customers sits in Salesforce.com. I'm on premises with an incident system, for example, that says, hey, you opened up bug 2123. So again, this is pretty realistic, ignoring this stuff sitting in the cloud. Most organizations do not have a single customer store. It's really hard to do that. So customer, for example, is usually partially sitting in multiple different apps. So whether this is cloud or not, doing good service-oriented practices in BizTalk lets you orchestrate that request. Doesn't matter if it's hosted here or hosted here. Yes, I pissed off Alan. So, what? On premises? I'm out of here. So, I've got my BizTalk server ESB. And then, of course, the actual query application that queries and asks for customer is sitting on a big load balanced Amazon Web Service instance so that maybe a lot of my customers use this. I want to scale this up and I don't feel like hosting this in my own data center. Now, to make all this magic happen, well, I've once again, like we just saw, need to punch through to my on-site ESB so I can make the initial request. So the flow is, keep up, coming in, going through the firewall, calls into BizTalk. Then BizTalk does all of its magic. It calls Salesforce.com, calls the Google App Engine, calls the internal application, munges it all together, throws it back through the service bus, and sends it back to Amazon. You say, you didn't build this. Yeah, so I built this. So, let's show, yeah, I built this all in PowerPoint. This was this is how architects do development now. What code? Who writes code? So let's look at my quickly look at my actual solution, just so you can see some of the moving parts. Yeah, of course. That is the Amazon instance we'll look at in a moment. So what we have in my actual Visual Studio solution is, I have references to the Salesforce schema. So that custom object I built, that customer service, that get customer by ID. Come on, zooming. There we go. Is right here. So there's that service I built in Salesforce.com, that custom WSDL it generated for me. Here's the BizTalk add web reference to it, or add reference to it, and I'm good to go. Now there's some things I'm hiding in here because technically when you call the Salesforce.com service, you have to pass in some session information, some secure keys to make sure you prove who you are. So I've built some static classes in BizTalk to call it once, cache it, and use it for all the subsequent requests. Now it actually expires every hour, so my static class has to expire every hour too, but this is the magic behind the curtain. So that's the Salesforce piece. On the Google App Engine side, now if you noticed, I didn't build a real SOAP service in there. I built something that takes in XML and gives me back XML over HTTP, just a typical POX type of web service. So, to keep Google happy, I just went ahead and built schemas that reflected that. Now you'll notice, hey, in BizTalk, I don't even need to use a namespace. This is technically an XML document with no namespace, and there's no problems with that. So this is the request. And here's the response that comes back from the App Engine. So I get back the ID of the user, the first name, the last name, which beta they're part of, all that stuff we saw in that user interface I built. So this is all weaved together in an orchestration where I'm doing aggregation. So once again, now this is that great scenario of building new services from existing ones. I could easily tell my end provider, you know what, you go call the Google App Engine, you go call Salesforce, you call my on-premises app, and have fun with that. Or I build nice coarse-grained services that say, ask for a customer, I go ahead and in parallel do the lookup incident system, lookup Google App Engine, lookup Salesforce, smash it all together, give you back one customer back. That's a much nicer way to give a service to an end user than asking them to do a lot of the heavy lifting. All right, so enough jabbering. Let's actually see if this works. So this is my Amazon-hosted instance, which I can prove by looking at the top. Oh, good Lord, there it is. So I've got my compute1.amazonwebservices.com thing. I just remote desktoped into that. And, of course, I can administer the Google App Engine, the Amazon service here. I've got one running instance. I've got one security group that defines which ports I should have open and things like that. So, you know, if I wanted to launch a brand new instance of something else, I get a bunch of base images I can start with if I want. Hey, here's a Windows image with SQL Server on it. Or, hey, here's a Ruby on Rails web starter running Fedora and Rails and all this sort of thing. And I don't pay for the software on these. I pay one hourly rate. Like I pay 12 cents an hour to keep my Windows instance up. You do this, it's like 10 cents for the non-Windows ones. So I can select one of these and get going. I can build my own image, snapshot it, upload that to the Amazon cloud, and simply use that as well. So if you have some app that you've built and you want to scale it up and down as much as you want, snapshot an image, and you know, when I come on demand here, let's say I do pick this one, try not to launch another instance. You can pick which ports you want to have open. And then I can say, how many instances do I want? 1, 100, 1,000, 50, 72? And when that happens, it will launch that many instances of that image. So again, you think about your web app, and it's the holiday season, and you want to throw up another 20 servers. Just take the same snapshot image, launch up another 20. They all can point to the same database, because your image might do that. And I've instantly scaled up, and I turn them off the next day, and I pay $30 or something. So it's a neat way to scale up and down without spending a lot in your own data center. And now before I incur more cost, I will actually cancel that. Okay, so my cloud instance is sitting out here, and I've deployed a web app here. And so this is the customer lookup application, where I'll type in an ID, it'll do all of its crazy magic, and then actually bring back the real customer object. So if we remember, where am I getting my data from? I've got three contacts here. They're actually three of the same contacts in Salesforce.com. The critical thing is they all have the same global identifier. So when I'm on that web app in Amazon and I say, give me customer 310, it's going to go to both Google and Salesforce and get that same customer. Now, before I kick this off and forget to actually start everything in BizTalk and fail miserably, let's come back here and turn on our ports. So I've got two send ports here, one for the Google App Engine, which is pointing at that appspot.com public address, and another one that's pointing at salesforce.com. And just for the fun of it, one I use just the classic HTTP adapter, the other one I actually use the WCF adapter for basic HTTP. And I've got an orchestration, not you, get out of here, for aggregating profile, the one we looked at with all the parallel shapes. And then the final piece of magic is what we saw earlier, which is punching a hole from the service bus onto my on-premises ESB to kick all this off. So you all remember the scenario. So now we wait with bated breath to see if this really works. So I'll preface it by saying the first one will be slow. The first time it'll have to call into Salesforce, get the token back, cash it, and all that. But what this is doing now, if I roll the dice and look at my environment here, I should see stuff running. Easy. People are getting excited. Legs are shaking. Careful around here. Easy, people. It's just a demo. So if I look at the running service instances, I should see that request and that orchestration going. I'm foolishly thinking that making my machine run harder while trying to do a complicated demo is not brilliant. Let's see what happens. Okay, so I've got a couple of active executions. As you can see, it's actually calling the Google App Engine service. It's calling the Salesforce stuff. Hey, look at me. So it pulled back the guy. Now let's not do too many mirrors and smoke here. So let's come back to one of my contacts that's in the Google App Engine. I mean, I should have established trust by now. You should know I'm not faking it, but that's fine. So let's look at my coworker Fred here, and his number is 4200. But let's go into Salesforce and actually change his information a bit, so you don't think I'm just caching all this. So I look at my buddy Fred, and what are some pieces of information I pulled back here? Things like title. So let's make it easy. What should his title be?
Astronaut.
Look at you. $30 to the man in the back. Man, if I could spell astronaut. I think he's a plumber. There we go. I can spell that. That's very easy to spell. Librarian. Yeah, code monkey or plumber. That's right. So, okay, so Fred's a plumber. And so let's go back to here, and this is 4200 is his ID. Look him up, and this one should be actually pretty quick. It'll go on site ESB, yada yada, call all of its stuff, and I should hopefully get Fred back, and he is indeed a plumber. Look at that. Thank you. But wait, there's more. If you call now. Now, so after this, so that was one case, right, as I'm punching out to the cloud and I'm calling and orchestrating stuff. What I want to show you next, though, yeah, we did see that bad boy in action. So the next thing we want to do is, if I have all these customer sources, maybe I do have partners who are masters of this data, and it actually is you store customer, you store customer, you store customer, and I want to make sure that they're all sending information to each other. So, hey, I just got a new customer. Hey, so did I. Hey, did I. And start shipping that information around. So what if everyone could send their customer profile updates? What if they could tell each other changes and things like that? So the solution might look like this. So I start off, probably my scenario today, because most people aren't doing cloud yet, is that I've got some sort of couple CRM applications, and I've got my on-site ESB, and these guys communicate with each other, right? They, hey, a customer got added, customer changed. They're all just happy going back and forth. All of a sudden, we did a merger and acquisition. We work with a partner. Hey, they want to play with us too. And actually, there's a couple of them. They both want to play. So what I can do is, once again, use our friend, the .NET Service Bus, and now have them come in through the Service Bus endpoint into my ESB, which of course means they'll also go here, right? Because I'm just publishing customer. These guys just care about customer. They don't care where it comes from because I've loosely coupled everything. Now, to make it more interesting, when I send customers back to these guys, I would have two choices, wouldn't I? I could send it to you, and I could send it to you, and if I change partners, I got to do another one. If I get rid of a partner, I'll do another one. Or I can use one of the .NET bindings, which is the event relay, which event relay says, here's an endpoint, and I'm going to let multiple people listen on that endpoint. Because by default, if you think about it, one service, one endpoint sort of thing. The event one, I could have n number of subscribers all on the same endpoint. And when I call the service, they all get it. So I've almost got dual sets of publish and subscribe here. BizTalk's publishing and subscribing. When he sends data back to the cloud, one endpoint in the cloud, it goes to both places. So now when I bring on new partners, I just tell them to listen in on the endpoint. When I get rid of a partner, I invalidate their credentials or I knock them off. I don't have to change anything here to actually make that happen. I just limit their access to that broadcast endpoint. Does that scenario kind of make sense? Can we show it off? Okay, so let's see how we do that sort of fan out, fan in. Let's see if I can leave on a high note. All right, so if we go back to my application, and let's turn off all the existing stuff. And just so you can see what we have we're sending the customer message around again. I will just leave it at that. Why make it complicated? So what I want to do is have two applications that both listen in on that endpoint, and then we'll watch messages going around. But let's start with the base case first, which is my internal app all in the firewall. I pick up customers, I send customers, file drop, that's it. So we start off, we've got customer sync file, customer sync via file. These might be my two internal apps that take file drops for customer records. And when I start with, all I have is one customer pickup that those two systems write to. So this is how I'm doing that internal shuffling of customers. It's just file drops, no fancy newfangled cloud thing. So if we look, once again, nothing up my sleeve, those file folders are empty. If I go ahead and grab a customer, and paste it as you would expect in your basic BizTalk scenario, it's going to go throw it to those two file drops. Because they're subscribing on a customer, not the port, they're subscribing on a customer message. And hopefully I come here and whew, that didn't work. That would have been up a creek. So I've got both of those working. Now I want to start engaging the cloud. So on the send side, I turn on one cloud endpoint. Now it's not technically, well, if you're actually looking at the moment, I'm not hitting the cloud endpoint because BizTalk doesn't play nicely with one-way WCF bindings. think I've seen some ways recently you might be able to get around that. But so what I did was build a NetPipes proxy service, which does nothing but take the message in, and that service, any WCF service, then can consume a one-way binding. So I've just built a little adapter, if you will, that takes in data from BizTalk and then calls the cloud. Because BizTalk calling that cloud binding directly, I couldn't get that to work. Okay, so that's sending a message to the cloud. And then the last piece is getting data back from the cloud. So this is when my vendor not only receives customer updates, they can initiate customer updates. Okay? So everything technically in BizTalk's turned on. This is a messaging-only solution of synchronizing stuff. The excitement is palpable in here. So let's look, and I'm going to put this running application on multiple machines. I am going to put one here. And so when I click Start Listener, what he's actually going to do is now bind to that endpoint in the cloud, the event endpoint. And so hopefully if that works, I'll throw something in my little log that says listener started. There we go. So he's listening. Now, because I'm using that relay binding, I can jump back to my Amazon cloud, start up a similar version of the app for a different client, and I can now he can also listen on it. So now I've got two guys both listening on that same endpoint. Okay, this is where the fun starts. So what I want to do now is we'll take the same customer, because why be picky? And I'm going to go pick it up again. So the equivalent of now one of my internal systems just published a new customer. So what I hope to see is not only it go to my two file folders on my machine, I hope to see it get broadcast to the cloud providers. Which, as you see, one's on my desktop and one's in the Amazon cloud, so nowhere close to my actual BizTalk environment. So it's not going to be interesting to see it show up here, which it just did. Let's see if I can race the clock, and there we go. Okay, so hopefully I'm going to see it pop into both of these characters, because they are both now subscribing on that message coming in. This is where I need a drum roll sound in my actual presentation.
It's the train down under, so we could...
Good times. So he just fanned it out to the cloud. Oh, but wait, there's more. I got one more for you. So it's two-way, because I want the cloud guy to be able to ship it back to my on-premises stuff as well. So he gets stuff, but this guy could also decide to take something else. I don't know what Newman's last name is.
Hello.
Huh?
Hello.
That's good. Okay, let's give him an email address. Okay, so I've got a new contact. Yeah, I can't have question marks as a last name. He's not Prince. So let's give him a... Newman, hello. I like it. So now when he sends his changes, he should show up over here, but then more importantly, he should show up on my on-site file drops that were sitting in my file folders. So let's go ahead and send changes. And he should show up over here. Submitted his updates. Come on, Newman. Hey, Newman, hello, shows up over here. Hold your applause. That's very presumptive, isn't it, that you're going to applaud? And then I come over here and say, okay, well, 11:30, hopefully this is our good friend Newman. And indeed, he now came to my on-site ESB as well. There you go. Yeah, exactly. Next, I will bring in a dancing bear who will also run the next demo. So we saw two different ways I might use the cloud there, right? I could use it to simply orchestrate services. I could also use it to do some more cross relationships and multi-master situations between that. So SOA still matters. The idea of service and architecture is still relevant. You know, building good services, designing good contracts, not just using the tool set to quick push out things that aren't service-oriented. You know, sometimes we're a victim of our tooling. The tooling is so simple to create new schemas that don't care about a namespace or use Wizard to generate endpoints. We can do all that stuff, but sometimes you take that extra effort to say, let's build good cross-platform, interoperable, reusable bits. And then when I start bringing in cloud vendors, I apply those same principles. You know, my cloud services should have the same principles applied, and from a BizTalk world, calling Google App Engine look virtually no different than calling any on-premises service, because I'm familiar with the same patterns. So, you know, from the cloud perspective, I don't think I included anything about this. These are fun environments to play with. You know, you're not going to be able to get away from this. Your customers are going to ask for this. You're going to want to play with this. So I'd recommend you at least, you know, Amazon's the only one in all of these that costs me anything. Salesforce.com is a free account. Google App Engine's a free account. Windows Azure is something for now. I think it's free for now, and as long as you can get the magic ticket. So most of these, you don't have to pay to spend time with them, but it's going to be good to diversify your skill set. If you are a Microsoft person, I'd encourage you to look at one of the other ones just to get that experience and throw a Java app out there or somehow learn Python and have fun with that. So look at your existing BizTalk projects. Look for good excuses to use some of the cloud platforms. It's going to be some of the wave of the future, but arguably, this kind of gives new life to your on-site ESP. I mean, I would argue, hopefully after this, you might kind of argue with me, is that your on-site ESP can play a great role in the cloud services. You know, I don't have to put everything into some sort of hosted environment to do cool orchestration or tie things together. How many of the companies we work with have invested millions of dollars on their on-premises software? So I can still use my on-site ESP, talk to my core on-premises stuff, but now really start doing some cool new stuff with what's in the cloud. Thanks for having me. Call me anytime via email. And hopefully I'll come back again sometime. Thanks.